This is the Book of Mormon, Digging Deeper. I'm your host, Mark Swent. Have you ever wondered how the term buck came to represent a dollar? As in, all you can eat for under a buck? Or maybe more realistically, all you can eat for under 10 bucks? It's really quite interesting, and its roots go back to the founding of this nation. You see, a brand new nation has to start off with some kind of currency or value to trade back and forth for goods and services. Our young country didn't have its own currency early on. Instead, the people used a mix of Spanish, Portuguese, and English money. It was unwieldy, and different colonies valued the money differently, making trade almost impossible. What might buy a bushel of barley in one colony could buy two bushels or half a bushel in another colony. Standardization did not exist, so barter became a common and accepted form of exchange. All kinds of things were bartered, and some became more common forms of value than others. Not money per se, but with an established value nevertheless. One of these items was the cleaned and ready for tanning hide of a white-tailed deer. One skin was equivalent to the value of a bushel of barley. It had the same purchasing value as $1 and was referred to as a buck. The term quickly caught on as a slang term for a dollar and continues to this day. Early in American history, a number of interesting commodities became common forms of payment, including beaver pelts and even squirrel pelts. As a matter of fact, squirrel skins are still an accepted form of payment in Finland to this day. They're valued at 3 cents per skin. Legend has it that Manhattan Island was purchased by Peter Minuit from the Canarsie Indians in 1626 for $24 of wampum. That's not quite true. It was not wampum, but rather pots and pans and knives, as well as buttons and cloth. And the sale was not legitimate because the Canarsie were not the owners of the island. They were just passing through and saw a great opportunity. It seems the real owners of the island were the Wappinger Confederacy, another group of Native Americans. So the Dutch had to negotiate another deal a few years later. And speaking of wampum, wampum beads were very popular for trading with the Native Americans, but also had a value among the settlers. Wampum beads were valued because of the difficulty in making them. They were made from the shells of the North Atlantic channeled whelk, a spiral-shaped sea snail. The acquisition of the shell was very difficult, as was the labor-intensive process of making the bead, thus giving them an intrinsic value. The white and purple beads were fashioned from the shell of the Western Atlantic quahog, a hard-shelled clam that is common from Cape Cod to New York. By the way, this is where Peter Griffin and family get the name for their town in the popular TV show, The Family Guy. They live in Quahog. Other commodities were traded for value as well. But perhaps the most interesting, at least to me, was bear oil. That's right, bear oil. It was extremely desirable for a number of uses, including cooking, and there were a great many bears, which were a very common food source in those days. Daniel Boone made a very good living as a bear hunter. The oil was rendered from the bear fat and stored in a skin pouch that was made from the neck skin of the white-tailed deer. I don't know the etymology of the word, but the quantity of bear oil that the pouch could hold was called an eel, and eels were quite commonly traded for other goods such as beans, wheat, and other commodities. From the beginning, people all around the world have needed some way to trade what they had for what they needed. Without centralized banks, they were left to devise their own forms of barter and value. Americans weren't the only ones faced with this dilemma. Interesting forms of payment existed, and still do exist, in many parts of the world. For example, in the Solomon Islands, dolphin teeth were an established form of payment. Cowrie shells, a little tiny seashell, were probably the quote-unquote dollar of the world for a few centuries, as they were used almost everywhere as a form of exchange. For centuries, salt was a very common form of currency. S-A-L, sal, is the Latin word for salt, and the word salary comes from the Latin word salarium, meaning salt money. The Romans paid soldiers, officers, and civil administrators an allowance of salt, and salarium came to be the term for military pay after salt was no longer used to pay the soldiers. There is also evidence that the ancient Mayans of Guatemala may have used salt as a currency as well. Another form of edible currency, believe it or not, was Parmesan cheese. At one point, this cheese was actually accepted as bank collateral in Italy. In Central America, the cocoa bean was the food currency of choice, and in Central Asia, they used tea bricks. These bricks were actually preferred in Mongolia because they could be brewed or even eaten as a source of nourishment. According to the Greek historian Herodotus, while some forms of metal coins had existed long before, the first gold and silver coins appeared in the kingdom of Lydia, today part of western Turkey. That was right around 600 BC, right at the beginning of the Book of Mormon. Herodotus tells of the legend of a man named Gyges of Lydia. That's G-Y-G-E-S, and it's pronounced Gyges, who was the richest man in the world. A mythology arose around Gyges because of his great wealth. Plato recounts the story of the ring of Gyges, which is just fascinating. This was a ring that, when worn, made the wearer invisible so that he could do whatever he wanted. Then the great debate arose as to what type of man could wear the ring of Gyges, and it was decided by Plato that all men would become evil and lascivious if given invisibility. He reasoned that such a man could walk through any market and pick up any treasure. An invisible man could sneak into any parlor and have any woman he wanted. He could do anything he wanted with impunity as long as he wore this ring. Socrates, on the other hand, maintained that a truly just man is not the slave to his appetites, so that his opportunities afforded by the ring would not tempt him to abandon his principles. It was an interesting debate. So here you have this ring that made you invisible, gave you unlimited power, and was so powerful that only the most virtuous man could wear it. Does that sound familiar at all? How about Lord of the Rings? J.R.R. Tolkien's great trilogy, in which Bilbo Baggins, the humble little hobbit, is the only one righteous and pure and truly virtuous enough to be the caretaker of the ring. This is where Tolkien got his inspiration for his story. And what about the location? How did he come up with Middle Earth? Well, I can tell you, it's right there in front of us. The Mediterranean Sea was the center of the world in the days of the Greek and Roman empires. You had Rome, you had Greece, you had Turkey and Egypt and Libya, all the way around the Mediterranean. And so, the word Mediterranean is the key. Let's break it up. Medi, which in Latin means middle, and terra, which means earth, middle earth. The Mediterranean is the Middle Earth Sea. It's just an interesting sidelight, but I thought you might find that interesting. The ancient Greek monetary system was built around the drachma, with values of 1, 2, 4, and 10 drachmas, and in lesser coinage of 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6 osoles, and 6 osoles equaled 1 drachma. Amazingly, the drachma persevered through 10 centuries, that's 1,000 years, right up to the Roman period. And then, unbelievably, it was reintroduced in Greece in 1828 and lasted until the introduction of the euro in 2002, an extraordinary accomplishment for an ancient currency. The old Roman currency, which followed the Greeks, was built on the denarius and was much more complex. The Romans had coins for less than a penny. They had a quarter of a penny, a third of a penny, 4/10 of a penny, half a penny, 1, 2, 2.5 pennies, and then, of course, the denarius would equal $1, we'll say. The denarius was the currency at the time of the Savior and was worth roughly one day's wages for a laborer. The Old English system came out of the Roman system and until 1971, when it was decimalized, exhibited the same complexity. I would like to explain that one to you, but try as I might, I just can't quite figure it out. Let me just share this from a man named John Curd. He wrote, "I was born in 1943. The money used in our village was farthing, halfpenny, penny, threepence bit, sixpence, shilling, 2 bob bit, half crown, 10 bob note, pound note, 5 pound note. The crown coin was limited. I don't think there was a 5 pound coin, and I believe the guinea was and still is just of value and not a coin or note. A more reasonable system in the world was the Egyptian system, which was almost the most efficient system in the world. Almost. The Egyptian system was based on 1, 2, 4, and 8. For example, to make 17, one would require 2 8s and a 1. Whereas in the American decimal-based system, using our money, you would need a dime, a nickel, and 2 pennies. That's 3 coins for the Egyptian versus 4 coins in the American system. In America, the first money, in the form of different types of notes or scrip, began to appear starting in about 1690, but really taking off around the beginning of the Civil War in 1861. As banks and other reliable financial entities started up, they would each issue their own currency. But it was not without risk. Financial institutions had a hard time getting established and often failed, as many did in the Great Bank Panic of 1842. Many people lost all they had in those failures. During the Civil War, the South needed their own currency as they were trying to secede from the Union. Of all the banks that helped finance their Civil War effort, the Bank of New Orleans turned out to have the most trusted currency, and in particular, their $10 note was the most popular. Bowing to the strong French influence in that city, the note quickly took upon itself the French-inspired nickname Dixie, after the French D-I-X, which is French for 10. Soon, the South became known as the Land of Dixie, and the term has lasted now for over 160 years. The current political climate may change that, but we'll see. Well, all of this is interesting, but I think we should get to the Book of Mormon. Money isn't particularly an important subject in the Book of Mormon, although there is the part about Lehi leaving all their gold and silver behind when they left for the wilderness. And then there is the time right after that when Nephi and his brothers went back and offered all that gold and silver to Laban in exchange for the brass plates. There is, however, never any lamenting or wistfulness about the wealth they left behind in Jerusalem. Other than that, money figures about as prominently as it does in the Bible, which is not very much. Except for that one time in Alma 11. Let's take a look at that. Mormon isn't writing to talk about money. He is relating the story of Alma and Amulek being confronted by the wicked judge Zeezrom. The record says that Zeezrom tried to bribe Amulek into denying God for 6 onties of silver, which, it turns out, is about 1.5 months' wages for a judge. Apparently, Mormon figured it would be wise to explain the monetary system to us as he relates the story, in order to give us a perspective of Zeezrom's bribe attempt. Author John Welsh has this to say. Midway through one of the most heart-wrenching accounts in the Book of Mormon, when Alma and Amulek were on trial for their lives and Amulek's faithful women and children were put to death by fire, the story is interrupted with an explanation of King Mosiah's system of weights and measures. It is a strange interruption, a mundane hiatus, but at least a relieving diversion as the tension mounts in Alma and Amulek's showdown with Zeezrom and the legal officials of Ammonihah. Why would one bring up these incidental economic nuts and bolts at such a point in the record? We learn from the record that up to that time, the people had used an accommodating barter system that apparently worked well enough. It was King Mosiah who devised the system about to be introduced. The account in Alma 11 is a very serious story, and we find Alma and Amulek fighting for their lives. This would seem to be an odd time to bring up money, but personally, I think Mormon put it in there to show the motivation of many of these wicked judges and lawyers and just how greedy they were. The record is very clear about the integrity, or rather the lack thereof, of these men. Verse 3 starts with the basic premise, acceptable enough, and in fact, according to the ruling set forth by Mosiah himself. It says, "Now it was in the law of Mosiah that every man who was a judge of the law, or those who were appointed to be judges, should receive wages according to the time which they labored to judge those who were brought before them to be judged." Now, the word wages had been used earlier in the record, but it was never used for money, but as in wages of sin, or his wages and everlasting punishment, or for his wages he received death. Rather grim. This is the first time the word wages is used to represent some monetary value. And the interesting thing to me is that as the record is recorded, it almost seems as though the monetary system is mentioned as an afterthought, or at least as an aside in the discussion of judges receiving wages for their work. It is not the main topic of discussion. It is not like Mormon says they had a complete and complex monetary system. No, he's talking about judges and decides to tell us what they made as judges. However, the record contains a remarkable amount of detail for an ancillary aspect to the story. As part of that story about corrupt judges and lawyers, Mormon shows us the power of that money. He says in verse 20, "Now it was for the sole purpose to get gain, because they received their wages according to their employee. Therefore, they did stir up the people to riotings and all manner of disturbances and wickedness, that they might have more employee, that they might get money according to the suits which were brought before them. Therefore, they did stir up the people against Alma and Amulek." After this, we have a tense but ultimately wonderful story about the conversion of Zeezrom, and the talk moves on to his missionary work with Alma and Amulek. The subject of money is left behind, and like so many other remarkable details in the Book of Mormon, it's never really mentioned again to any degree afterwards. Nevertheless, the monetary system deserves a close look and is not to be overlooked, because of the extraordinary evidence it provides. Now, a recurring theme in many of my podcast episodes so far has been the fact that the skeptic would have to be impressed with the level of detail included in the Book of Mormon stories. This monetary system is no exception. Nothing comes close to it in the Bible. In the Sermon on the Mount, it mentions a farthing, and the widow offered her 2 mites to the treasury, but that is about the extent of money. Oh, there is the bit about the money changers in the temple. The Book of Alma not only gives names to all the gold and silver measures, but also gives their relative values so that we can comprehend their monetary system. And this entire system is only mentioned this one time in the story of Alma and Amulek and Zeezrom. And here is where we find something extraordinary. But before I go over the Nephite money system, let me clarify that the word coin or coinage is never used in the Book of Mormon. It has been made clear by numerous scholars that coins should not be assumed. It would have been just as easy to say measures of gold and silver, but in this context, I think I might be forgiven if I use the term coin, if only for the sake of comparison with other monetary systems, and to appeal to the commonly held perception of money in our modern times. Now again, let me mention the Egyptian monetary system for just a moment. It was based on the sequence 1, 2, 4, and 8, and is considered a very efficient system. Against this, we have the Nephite monetary system, which was designed around 1, 2, 4, and 7, plus the lesser coins of 1 half, 1 quarter, and 1 eighth of the primary measure, the senine. That's S-E-N-I-N-E. The other measures, or coins if you prefer, were the seon, the shum, and the limnah. And that was all in gold. The equivalent measures of silver were also described. The onti of silver that Zeezrom offered Amulek to deny God was the equivalent of 7 senines, and he was offered 6 of them, or 42 senines, a considerable amount. Considerable research has proven that this system may very well be the most efficient monetary system in the world. You can check this for yourself in your spare time by picking any value and seeing how many coins it would take to make it. Or I can save you some time and summarize for you. First of all, for the sake of simplicity, let's consider the 1, 2, 4, and 7 values to be dollars and the lesser small change to be coins. Now, in fact, there never is any clarification of just exactly what form this money took, but as I said earlier, for our purposes, the more common dollars and cents will serve just fine. The Nephite dollars run neck and neck with the Egyptian system, considered by many to be the most efficient. If you run all the numbers from 1 to 25 and count up the total cumulative number of coins that it would take, the Egyptian money will come out $1 less than the Nephite system. The American system is far behind, and I can't even figure out the old English system. However, if you consider the small coins and figure the number needed for any value 1 through 25, the Nephite system beats the next best system, the Egyptian system, by 11 coins on a cumulative basis, and the American system by fully 24 coins. That makes it, the Nephite system, the most efficient monetary system in the world. Now you may ask, why did I only count from 1 to 25? Well, that's because once you get to 25, you can then just double or quadruple those same numbers all the way up to 100. And after that, it's just a repeating series all the way up. You can find a very complete summary of the required coins on a blog called Green Scooter and posted by Scott Nelson. Now, let me point out once again that the monetary system in the Book of Mormon was only included to give perspective in the story of Alma and Amulek appearing before Zeezrom. It was not intended to be a significant point of discussion. For the skeptic who would claim that Joseph Smith fabricated the Book of Mormon and made up everything in it, I would say, if that were so, why would a young man take the time to come up with the most efficient monetary system in the world and then only mention it once? And that just to get perspective on the bribe of a corrupt lawyer. I don't know, but I think if I were the author, my ego would want me to make sure the reader knew just how clever I was. It seems to me that had the story been made up, it would have been much easier to simply say that Zeezrom offered Amulek 20 of something, or 50 of something, or 100 of something. Kind of the same way that Judas was offered 30 pieces of silver. We are not told what denomination those pieces were. We are not told what the purchasing power of those pieces were, or their names. We only know that he was given 30 pieces of something. If Joseph had had to quickly come up with denominations and values for the story, why would he, as a young, uneducated kid from New York, devise a system based on 1, 2, 4, and 7? Why not just stick with the decimal system that Thomas Jefferson had employed for U.S. money just a few decades earlier? And if he did just happen to come upon 1, 2, 4, and 7 out of thin air, how lucky is that, that he would have just happened to beat the reigning best system in the world, the Egyptian system? That subtle change from 1, 2, 4, 8, which makes sense, by the way, just doubling each time, to 1, 2, 4, and 7 was a stroke of genius and very counterintuitive. I guess the skeptic would just have to chalk that up to pure luck. Me? I don't think so. Just like everything else in the Book of Mormon, I think we have here another example of the wonderful detail that the Book of Mormon authors included in their records to give depth and understanding to the tale they were telling. I'm so glad they did. I love the richness of the Book of Mormon stories. As the words fall onto my heart, I can hear real men speaking from real experience, not fantasy. I know the stories in the Book of Mormon are true. I know the Book of Mormon is true. I testify to you that the Book of Mormon is authentic. It is the real and true account of a people that lived long ago on the American continents. They grew. They prospered when they were righteous. They failed when they were wicked. And they died, leaving us a record of their deeds. They are truly a voice whispering out of the dust. And I, for one, count myself blessed for having the Book of Mormon in my life. Until next time, I'm Mark Swint. Thank you for listening.